Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We are ready to hear the first case for this morning, Germano against International Profit Association and others. Mr. Stein.
May it please the court, my name is Michael Stein. I am going to be splitting oral argument, and I am going to be talking for the next 5 minutes about two issues. First, the district court made an error of law when it held that statements may be a relay operator and inadmissible hearsay. Second, this issue has been properly preserved through appellate review. When two hearing people speak over the telephone, and what one person says to the other may be admissible in court at the admission of a party opponent under Rule 801b2. The district court erred in creating a different rule to statement made through a relay operator so that the same exact statement would be inadmissible in evidence because you have a deaf person communicating with a hearing person through a relay operator. The district court erred because it placed undue weight on the presence of the relay operator. The relay operator does nothing more than to read out loud, word for word, what a deaf person types into the DTY, and to type into the DTY, word for word, what the hearing person said.
Excuse me, Mr. Stein, I wonder if you could address the second of the two points you mentioned, namely whether this issue has been preserved properly for us, since your opponents place a great deal of stress on that point.
The issue has been properly preserved because the plaintiff offered the evidence and complied with Rule 103A2. He did that by making clear the nature of the evidence and the significance of the evidence, and then the defendant objected to the evidence, and they specifically cited Rule 801B2, and they made the argument that the relay operator is not a transparent conduit. And the district court considered the evidence and considered the argument whether the relay operator is a transparent conduit and explicitly ruled on it, so devoted a portion of its opinion to that issue.
So did you cite the cases to the district court that you've mentioned here?
Yes, we cited the cases in our motion for reconsideration because after the district court made a ruling, we came forward and filed a motion for reconsideration, and we cited Rule 801B2 and 807, and cited cases. We did not cite Rule 803.1, but that was not necessary because under Rule 103A2, all you need to do is to present the evidence, make clear the nature of the evidence, and the significance of the evidence. And further, this is a very important issue for appellate review, as the government has filed two amicus briefs, and if the circuit court allows the district court ruling to stand, it will have a devastating impact on the millions of Americans who use and rely on relay services for everyday matters, like calling the bank or calling the doctor. They would not be able to do that. And that would be in contravention to the American Disabilities Act, which provides that relay calls are to be the functional equivalent of a telephone call between two hearing people. The most closely analogous case law concerns interpreters, like Spanish interpreters. This court has held that interpreters, statements made through interpreters, are admissible in evidence as non-hearsay. Our case is even stronger than that for two reasons. First, when you have an interpreter, the interpreter must alter the grammar, syntax, and word order. For example, going between English and Spanish, and something may be lost in translation.
I have a factual question about the way this works, and that is whether it is possible to know who the communications assistant is for any given call. The district court seemed to think you need to call the assistant. But does anybody know which communication assistant handles each phone call?
Yes. One numerical relay, the relay operator can do identify himself or herself by number. So I might say, I am relay operator number 5731. So you have a record of that. I see that my time is up. I would like to withdraw my time to you, brother.
Thank you. Mr. Sonier.
Morning. Morning, counsel. My name is Uche Asone, and I'm here to discuss why this case should go to a jury for a trial. The facts of the case are relatively simple. Mr. Germano saw an advertisement on the internet for a tax consultant position and submitted an application to Mr. Sage. Mr. Sage,
can I ask you? Yeah, because we're familiar with the facts, and I don't mean to be rude, counsel, but I know you have limited time. Because my question really goes to, this position required extensive travel and face-to-face contact with clients. Wouldn't a defendant be required to hire another individual to provide the plaintiff with sign language services in order to complete his duties? Because I want to get to that issue of what the hardship might be for the employer.
Your Honor, a couple of responses. During the entire case, there was no affirmative defense raised on that issue. And also, in fact, defendants had taken the position all throughout the litigation that they could accommodate the disability without difficulty. In fact, the email that they had sent to Mr. Germano said that the individuals who made the decision specifically considered the disability and found that it was not an obstacle that could not be gotten over.
Of course, that begs the question. The question is, would he have to have an interpreter with him full time when he was on the road?
I do not believe that he had to have an interpreter full time with him when he was on the road, because there was a combination of different things that could be used to accommodate him if we got to that issue.
On the road? There would be something. What specifically would you think they could use to accommodate it?
Your Honor, right now they have video conferencing where an individual doesn't have to accompany him with the TTY system. So there are situations where he could set it up where he could use the computer, and someone could be, if he needed, actually for someone to translate for him, if he, assuming that he couldn't read the lips, or that there were no other ways of communicating, there are video mechanisms for doing so where he could have his computer and in front of him, and a conversation could be held where he is actually getting a translation from elsewhere relayed to him on his computer.
Does the record show what his lip reading skills are?
Your Honor, throughout the litigation, that was really not an issue. However, it was assumed when he sent an email to them describing to them how he could do his work, he included that as one of the things that he could do. His accommodation would depend on what he's doing. If it's a face-to-face, one-to-one meeting, sometimes, depending on if you have multiple parties, then there would be situations where he may need an interpreter, but he would not need a full-time interpreter.
Well, I had a different question, which was which goes to the issue of his qualifications for the job vis-a-vis others who have been hired for this position. Is it your position in the end that IPA should have hired him? Is it your position in the end that they should have interviewed him? What exactly do you hope to get from this litigation?
Your Honor, we hope that he should have been interviewed and he should have been hired. Defendants, when they were asked who applied for the position, they indicated that there were a total of three candidates for the specific position that he applied for, and that was Mr. Vortridi and Mr. Enriquez. Mr. Enriquez already had a position before Mr. Germano applied. Mr. Vertrudy could not meet the travel requirements, so the only other person who was qualified and applied for that same position was Mr. Germano. So likely he would have received the position, especially given that his qualifications exceeded the qualifications of his educational qualifications, exceeded the normal qualifications that some of the other people had. He graduated with an LLM degree from Georgetown University.
Right. So, but I guess what I'm trying to get at is whether the fundamental nature of your claim is more like that in the Title VII case, Hopkins against King and Spalding, where it was the opportunity to compete, for, in that instance, for a partnership that was at issue. It's very hard to say, had he gotten the interview, that you know for a fact he would have gotten the job or he wouldn't have gotten the job. But are you focusing on the loss of an opportunity or the loss of the job?
Your Honor, we're focused on both, the lost opportunity for the interview and the loss of the job, of the ability to actually be employed, given that he was the only other candidate standing at the time that has been identified as part of the record.
If you want to save rebuttal time, I'm just going to alert you. It's a little bit behind the computer.
Okay. Yes, I will save rebuttal time.
Okay. Thank you. And we'll hear from Mr. Zolna.
Good morning. J.C. Zolna on behalf of the defendants' appellees. I agree with Mr. Sonia that this case is rather simple. There are three facts in this case that are undisputed by both sides. And that demonstrate in no uncertain terms that there was no discrimination here and that plaintiff was treated just like the hundreds of other candidates who apply for this job and are turned down every year.
I'm not sure that's true if you take into account his direct testimony about being offered an interview and then being told that he wasn't going to have an interview after his hearing impairment. In other words, I don't see how we can decide this without either deciding that we can put that evidence into our consideration or deciding that we will not put that evidence into our consideration.
Sure. Notwithstanding the fact that none of those issues were presented to the district court, which we've addressed
they
in our brief.
They were. I mean, you say it in a very extreme way, but I have this image that when you file briefs, for every piece of evidence you rely on, you run through the federal rules of evidence and have a paragraph about why each one wouldn't be subject to an objection under that paragraph.
But if, like the defendants did in the lower court, in the district court, if someone challenges the admissibility of that evidence, the other side has a duty.
Your reply brief.
Hmm?
You did in your reply brief.
I did it, or the defendants did it in accordance with the local rules, which allows us to submit a response to the plaintiff's additional statement of facts. That was where the conversation was first introduced in the district court, in his additional statement of facts. Defendants submitted a response to that.
And that, but his additional statement of facts, the way the lower court's rules work, was in the nature of a responsive document, and so yours was a reply. And the district court seems to have been perfectly aware this issue was before it.
Sure, and we had addressed other issues, other challenges to his statement of facts in that response brief, or in the reply. And Mr. Sonia asked the district court and was given permission to file a supplemental pleading to address some of these other issues that aren't relevant to this appeal. He did not address, he addressed those other issues, other evidentiary issues, and he had the last word, essentially, and he addressed those other issues in that supplemental pleading. He didn't touch the evidentiary challenge to the phone call. And after all, this court is a court of first impression or first resort, or it's not a court of first impression. It reviews decisions of a district court. There's nothing for this court to review because the district court never made a ruling on any of those issues.
It did, actually, because at a minimum in the Rule 59 order, after saying it had concerns about whether this was raised, it then went on and gave its ruling, said kind of in the alternative, here's what I think about all of these things. So at a minimum at that point, we know exactly what the district court thought.
But he also said, Judge Lindbergh also said at the beginning of that opinion that he it's not proper for him to address those.
So he does it in the alternative. He thinks maybe it's not proper, and that's his first option, but then he moves on, says, well, but in case it is, here's what I think.
I think more importantly, Your Honor, is that we weren't allowed to respond to his motion to reconsider. I believe it's either the local rules or maybe it's Judge Lindbergh's standing orders prevents a party from filing a responsive brief to a motion to reconsider. And
now you're making an argument very similar to the one he's made about the earlier stage. You never asked Judge Lindbergh to change that?
I did. I did call his clerk, and I asked if I could file a responsive pleading, and I was denied that opportunity. And I didn't have an opportunity to present any of the arguments that I'm now presenting for the very first time before this court.
Now, but you would agree our review is de novo anyway. This is just a question of law.
I actually disagree with that, and the plaintiffs disagree with that as well. A ruling on an evidentiary ruling in the district court is reviewed on an abuse of discretion standard.
Once we know what the rule is, but if it deals with the content of what exactly is covered by a rule in a generic sense, that's a question of law. Then the applicant, you know, this happens all the time with Rule 702, for example. Understanding what the actual structure is a question of law. Applying that structure to a particular expert is a matter reviewed by abuse of discretion.
If your question is whether the district court applied the procedural laws properly,
what does Rule 801 mean? That's the question. What is covered in the statements of a party or the party's agent? Is this communications operator a third speaker, if you will?
Well, I think there's no doubt. I mean, it is what it is. There's a third party involved.
But it isn't what it is, because we know from all the interpreter cases that just because there's a third party may not mean that it turns into hearsay.
That's true. There are some. There isn't any case law on the TDD issue. There are language interpreter cases out there, and what those cases stand for is there's not a per se rule stating that it's admissible or it's not admissible. Plaintiffs cited cases where the appellate courts of various jurisdictions have held that it was not abuse of discretion to admit such evidence. I've cited cases where circuit appellate courts have held that it was not an abuse of discretion to not admit that type of evidence. And all the case law says, both my cases and plaintiffs, say that it has to be looked at on a case-by-case basis. And if you look to the record in this case, as opposed to some of the assertions that are made in the pleadings, it's pretty clear that there really isn't even a dispute over what had occurred on that phone call. Mr. Sage testified very clearly in his deposition that, yes, he did talk to Mr. Germano about an interview. He talked about the possibility of him flying into Chicago for an interview, and that.
But there is a dispute of fact. Mr. Germano said he was offered an interview and then it was withdrawn, whereas Mr. Sage says it was discussed but nothing had come to fruition. This is a big difference.
That's what the pleadings say. If you read Mr. Germano's deposition, when he was under oath at his deposition, he wasn't so firm in his position. He more or less punted on that. When we asked him in his deposition whether he was absolutely certain that during that phone call there was an unequivocal offer for an interview as opposed to just talking about it. And he said, well, I believe that's what the case was. But then he followed that up by saying, I really don't recall exactly what was said. And then he followed that up by saying, conceding that it could have just been a mistake or a misunderstanding on his part. Those are the facts of this case. It may be different in another case.
That has nothing to do with the CA.
With the
communications assistant. It had nothing to do with how it was being translated, from the screen. Go ahead.
It has to do with the facts of this case, and it also has to do with the TDD operator call and what actually occurred, because Mr. Germano admitted that, first of all, he didn't confirm that it was an offer in his deposition. He did not confirm that. He also, in his deposition, said he doesn't remember, and he also said that it could have been a mistake.
But he also says, as I recall, that perhaps there are errors in the TD interpretation. But our law has said with foreign language interpreters that doesn't matter. We need some reason to think there was an error in this case, not some reason to think there wasn't.
Sure, and every one of their cases that they cite in the sign language the foreign language interpreter cases, every single one there is a contemporaneous corroboration. Either the interpreter is called to testify, or there's some contemporaneous record of what was interpreted. Every single one of their cases has that corroborating evidence. There are no such.
Well, with the exception of the fact that this case is different in the sense that there is a regulatory background that's quite different from what we have in the foreign language case.
And with respect to the FCC regulations that plaintiff cites in their brief, for the proposition that it's rare that a mistake would be made, Mr. Germano actually testified just the opposite in his deposition. He actually said in his deposition that he encounters interpretation problems all the time in real life. It's part of what happens with interpretations. Things get lost in translation. I'll actually quote something from his deposition. Question: have you had problems like this before with interpretation? Answer: anytime there is a translator, there's always the possibility that there could be some misunderstanding. He went on to state that, and I quote, sometimes that just happens with interpretations.
Right, and I don't doubt that he said that. I remember that, actually. Have you ever been talking on a cell phone with somebody where it gets crackly and you can't hear?
Sure.
So does that mean we should exclude all cell phone testimony because it might have been misheard?
Well, if I didn't hear it correctly and I...
No, should the court, because cell phone technology is vulnerable to that, should the court start excluding all accounts of conversations held on cell phones?
That certainly isn't a hearsay issue, and that's the
issue. No, but it's an unreliability issue, which is what hearsay is all about.
Well, if someone couldn't hear what was stated over the crackling, then no.
Well, we don't know. In one call, maybe you could. In the next call, you couldn't.
Well, the person.
So maybe we should just exclude them all because they're unreliable.
Well, the person who received the call could testify that, yes, I heard it, and there was some crackling, but I heard everything in the conversation.
So then if we rule in your favor, basically, when we look at the regulatory scheme and we look at the intent, in order to get a conversation in by a CA, that CA would have to be called to testify, or you'd have to get an affidavit from the CA. And then how does the CA recall all of that, know that it's accurate? I mean, is that what that would be the consequence of ruling in your favor, wouldn't it?
It would provide the opposing counsel an opportunity to attack the credibility of that person, the qualifications of that person, whether they had followed the regulations, what their policies were at the center, whether they actually followed the federal regulations, whether there was whether they were in noncompliance with an FCC order. Mr. Stein admitted that you can determine who this operator was, but that was
the operator's not permitted, as I understand, to take notes of the
exactly.
conversation.
So the operator can't. When you look at the rules and the regulations. I mean, the operator wouldn't even remember what was said.
But the operator, first of all, Mr. Germano testified that he did have a printer on his TED machine, and he could have just as easily printed off or kept or had that as a record, which would have been more in line with the cases cited in the language interpreter cases. As far as the operator goes, they may not recall a certain phone conference, but they certainly will be able to testify to their qualifications, whether their policies are followed and whether their policies are in compliance with the FCC regulations, and a number of other things that would affect the credibility of the statement. Right now we just have a statement from an unknown person that we're trying to use in a court to prove a case. And I think I've
Well, certainly you could find out through interrogatories what the procedures are at a particular call center or, you know, for because the number is identified on the call. But, I mean, in terms of you could determine what region handled the call center and whether or not they complied. You could do that with interrogatories.
I believe we actually subpoenaed one company that Mr. Germano testified about in his deposition. Or maybe it was an interrogatory, and there was, I think they said that they didn't keep, it wasn't the right entity or something along those lines. It's not part of the record because it was a dead end. It was the wrong company. So that's where that ended. And we're still sitting here with an unknown person.
So there wasn't an attempt to identify to identify another company?
There may have been another subpoena to another company.
And then I wanted to get back to this issue of your being able to file a reply. I understand you asked the judge's clerk whether you could file a reply. But and the clerk said no, but that doesn't, what the clerk says is not the law. I mean, you could have still filed a reply had the court rejected.
It's in his standing orders. It might even be
I understand it's in his standing orders, but you can always make an application asking for the court to make an exception. Right?
I could, and I just called the clerk instead as a matter of convenience because I did read his rules, and it said do not file a response brief, and I didn't want to
antagonize
when you're, when you're ahead of the game. I think summary judgment was just granted. I think it's a smart thing to know when not to say anything as opposed to say something. And instead of filing something formally with the court, I thought as a matter of convenience and as not to ruffle anyone's feathers, I would just simply call the clerk, which is in real life a fairly common practice to get things done. And day-to-day life.
Oh, no, I was on the district court for 15 years. I know about real life, but I also know there were exceptions sometimes, even though, you know, we all have standing orders. But sometimes the standing order doesn't, I mean, there's reason to give permission even in the face of a standing order. So that's why I asked the question.
I believe the turnaround date from the filing of the motion to reconsider to his actual order was extremely brief, a matter of days. Could I have prepared a brief like I did for this court within a matter of days? It would have been difficult. I would have had to put everything aside for 3 or 4 days in that small window I had between the order and the ruling.
Yeah, but I mean, normally if you want some kind of exception, you give the basis for it. You ask the court for additional time so you can fully brief it. I mean, there is a way it can be done. That's my only point.
Sure. Just one last point. I know my time is up. And I think a lot of the issues are addressed in our brief, so I'm not too concerned about addressing them here. But this case is not about a TV call. It's not about policy arguments or anything like that. It's about whether the plaintiff had any proof of discrimination. And there are undisputed facts showing that the job posting that he responded to said he needed work experience. He admitted in his deposition he did not have that work experience. And the historical hiring practice of the company, which is in the record, no one has been hired with that type of experience. And that doesn't change with a phone call or anything else.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Zolna. Anything further from Mr. Stein?
A few minutes ago, you had a opposing counsel about the subpoena, and you must not be done to the record. In this case, Mr. Romano, you the relay operator, from, you the relay service from the state of Maine, and the defendant subpoenaed the relay service from the state of Maine, and the state of Maine said, yes, we did do this relay call. However, our treaty regulation prohibits us from disclosing the content of the conversation, so we are not able to tell you anything about what happened during the course of the telephone call.
So it was these very regulations you're talking about that caused the state of Maine to, in a sense, terminate the discussion?
Through the FCC regulation.
Yeah.
And you had asked about whether rules should be under 801, under Rule 801D2. The rule under 801D2 should be treat this as if it happened a phone call between two hearing people. If that statement would be admissible in evidence, then the same with that conversation should be admissible in evidence as between the deaf person and the hearing person. So whether you call through a landline, through a cell phone, which might have a spotty reception, or through a relay operator, should not matter. They should all be treated identically. And yeah, still the possibility of a mistake. And the same as the possibility that when you have two hearing people speaking to each other, one party may mishear what the other party said. Or when you have a cell phone, you may have a spotty reception. All of these issues go to the weight of the evidence and not to the admissibility of the evidence. And about the case law concerning interpreting, all of the courts I've employed IP Sam to an environmental validity by statement might be an interpreter. I presume to be admittable in evidence and non hearsay. And the only doubt has been because in many cases an interpreter happened to be a foreign body. Nothing was known about that interpreter. So I wanted to know something about who that interpreter was. But every time there was a professional interpreter, an interpreter is specialized only in doing interpretation, has always been admissible in evidence. And we have the same guarantee with ICC regulation, always going to be qualified. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And Mr. Estonia, anything further?
I wanted to address briefly the reply brief issue. Briefing schedule for the summary judgment motion did not have a provision for a short reply for the plaintiff. Now, the motion that we did file after that was not a substantive motion. It was just to submit different and clear exhibits because what had happened was that when defendants submitted their exhibits, because of redactions, it appeared as though some of the exhibits were signed, and all we did was to ask the judge to give us permission to submit documents, the same documents without the redactions and without the stamps on them, to make sure that the judge understood which ones were signed and which ones were not signed. So we did not address any substantive issues, as the briefing schedule clearly did not allow us to do so. The other thing I wanted to address was the fact that Mr. Germano was offered an interview, and the only time that the interview was revoked was after the decision makers learned of his disability. The EEOC began to investigate, asked them why it was that Mr. Germano wasn't offered the position, and they said that it was because the position had been offered to Mr. Enriquez. Now, EEOC asked for backup. Give us documentation regarding Enriquez. After much back and forth, EEOC was able to obtain the documents from them showing that Enriquez had actually been offered a position and had accepted it before Germano's application. After that, Your Honors, the reasons began to change. The reasons started to change as to why he wasn't hired, and those changing reasons led to further changes in the identities of the decision makers, because as the reasons began to change and the stage began to change, Sage said he made the decision with Mr. Foster. Foster said he made the decision alone. Lang, the HR director, said that the decision was made by the people who actually were going to interview him. And this resulted from the fact that they had to continue to change the reasons for not hiring him. Why would they need to do that if they didn't hire him simply because he did not qualify? There shouldn't have been any cover-up. They should have just said that to the EEOC all along. The reasons continue to change to the present.
Yeah, and one of the things counsel says is that Germano, I just want to get to Germano's qualifications, that he didn't have adequate qualifications, but I thought at least two of the tax consultants that were hired lacked the work experience that they said they required.
That is true. In addition, they actually conceded that they didn't always apply that standard, especially here. Germano has an LLM in taxation. Most of the other candidates didn't have anything close to that. So it's plausible that, given that the two-year experience is generally a guideline and not strictly enforced, that they would probably not even apply to someone who was way more qualified education-wise than the other individuals that they're looking at or that they hired.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you to all counsel. We will take this case under advisement.